Welcome to the Chase Podcast. Dr. Ron Charles is a renowned archaeologist, author, historian, speaker, missionary, and is known as the Christian Indiana Jones. Visit cubitfoundation.org for Dr. Ron's books and information about this global ministry.
You know, in the Word of God, there was 129 different events recorded in the Gospels concerning the life of Jesus. These 129 events include his birth, his ministry, his parables, his miracles, healings, as well as his death and resurrection and ascension. 129 events. But the book of John, the author of the book of John, the very last verse of the book of John, says if all the events of Jesus' life were told, then all the books in the entire world would not be able to contain it. Now that's a lot of stuff. But yet, we have 129. What happened to the rest of it? What happened to those other volumes upon volumes upon volumes? Those hundreds and thousands and multiplied thousands of manuscripts and documents. We don't know. Destroyed, lost, misplaced, damaged. We don't know. But we do have 129. Why these? Why do we have these events and not some of the others that were damaged or were destroyed? I don't have an answer for that. I have an opinion. Now, this opinion of mine doesn't come from the Bible. An angel didn't whisper in my ear. It's just my opinion. I think that God the Father knew what we would need to live the life that we needed to live in the 20th and the 21st century. And the events of Jesus' life that we will need were preserved. Which means that every word, every punctuation, every capital letter that records these 129 events is important. And it is mandatory for our victorious life. That means this. There are no major events and minor events. There are no major sermons and minor sermons. There's nothing in this Gospels that will justify us reading on ahead until we get to some of the important. Okay? Every word is important. Tonight, we're going to discuss an event that all of us have heard about, but perhaps very few sermons that you've heard have been spoken about the event. All of us have heard dozens of stories about Jesus breaking the bread and the fish, right? Right? We've heard dozens of sermons about Jesus walking on the water. Dozens more of the raising of Lazarus, Zacchaeus up in the sycamore tree, and so forth. And you've heard of this event, but tonight we want to discuss not only the event itself, but the historical background of this event and why it's recorded for us today. We're going to read verse number 6 of chapter 6 of Luke. Luke 6 chapter, verse number 6. And it came to pass also on another Sabbath that he, meaning Jesus, entered into the synagogue and taught. And there was a man whose right hand was withered. Now, the word that was used in there is zizoxphysia. It's a Greek slash Persian word that means the dried hand of a stonemason. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him, meaning Jesus, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him. And he, meaning Jesus, knew their, the scribes and Pharisees, thoughts, and said to the man which had the withered hand, "Rise up and stand forth in the midst." And he arose and stood forth. Then said Jesus unto them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil? To save life or to destroy it?" And looking round about upon them all, he, meaning Jesus, said unto the man, "Stretch forth thine hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored whole as the other. And they, meaning the scribes and Pharisees, were filled with madness and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus. Mark's setting says how they might put him to death. Okay. This event took place in May of the year 28 AD. And it's one of those things that perhaps we as believers could categorize this as a minor event. What's significant is it is a guy who can't use his arm. That's not like raising from the dead. It's not like healing leprosy. Not like healing the blinded eyes. It's just a guy's arm. Well, there's a little bit more to it than that. And the story actually began 25, 30 years before this. During the time of Herod the Great, Herod was the king of the Jews at this time. The guy was an absolute monster. He was barbaric, right down to his core. And he was probably the most barbaric diplomat that Rome had in the East. But he was also one of the greatest politicians. Everyone hated Herod, and so he went out of his way to buy friendship. It was during his reign, Herod's reign, that for a 14-year period, for the first and only time in the history of the Jewish people, all the way from Abraham to Netanyahu, there's only one time during that 14-year period that every Jew who was able to and that wanted to had work. 0% unemployment. And that was during the reign of Herod, because he put to work the people by building roads, gymnasiums, temples, what we call today shopping centers, and places of entertainment, such as the arenas that you saw in the movie Ben-Hur. Okay, that was that circus or that racetrack was built in Jerusalem by Herod the Great. But his greatest accomplishment of all of the things that Herod built was the great temple in Jerusalem. The temple that Jesus, where Jesus ministered. Now, the temple in Jerusalem built by Herod was absolutely magnificent. Without exception, one of the greatest accomplishments ever by anyone. As a matter of fact, in my opinion, the temple of Jerusalem that Herod built should have been the eighth wonder of the ancient world. And the ninth wonder of the world is the fact that it was not the eighth. Okay? I mean, it was astounding. And the political abilities that Herod had was even more astounding, probably. he convinced Augustus Caesar to pay for a third of it. So a third of the cost of this, which is about $1 billion, came out of the treasury of Rome. Herod himself paid one third out of his own treasury, out of his own bank account, and then the Jews of Judea paid for the other third. And it was just astounding. Now, Herod wanted the best, absolute best artisans to work on this. So he demanded the world's greatest stonemasons to be to work on this facility. Of course, first of all, what Herod had done is they leveled the hill, the Temple Mount, and then put these monster stones in there as foundation. So there had to be a superstructure made and then a substructure before the walls itself was to come up. These stonemasons, they were in charge of this substructure and superstructure first, and that had to be before this magnificent building was to be. And so he chose as his construction manager a man who was named Yeshua Binzi. Well, now Herod appointed the priests at this time. He didn't care whether they were from the line of Zadok or Levi or not. Didn't matter to him. He just appointed them for political reasons. And part of this priestly family was the Binzi family. And Yeshua Binzi came from this priestly family, but he was an engineer. And he was the one who built this Ben-Hur arena type thing. And so he was in charge of building the temple, Yeshua Binzi. He received permission from Augustus Caesar to travel the world, any place where Rome was, in search of the world's best stonemasons. Well, come to find out, after a three-year search, he discovered that right there in Judea, right there in the Galilee, was the world's best stonemasons. So he chose 217, and these 217 stonemasons began work on this great, 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 magnificent temple. Well, as it was being built, Herod the Great began to receive a premonition that he was going to die before the temple was complete, and he did. But because of this premonition, he went to Yeshua Binzi and demanded that the stonemasons work in 8-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, around the clock, including the Sabbath day. Well, Yeshua said, I need to check with the high priest. At this time, the high priest was Jezar. I got to check with him. So he went to Jezar and says, we really don't have any choice. Herod is demanding this. And so the high priest gave his approval. And so the stonemasons began to work around the clock, 8-hour shifts on this temple. Well, Herod did die. His son inherited his throne, and he maintained the same policy. And he kept the same policy until their work on the substructure was complete, and before the walls of the main building were to go up, they decided they were going to have a great celebration to thank the stonemasons, draw attention to the great work they had done, and so forth. But by this time, the Romans were in absolute control. And Aurelius, the Roman governor, says, you're not finished yet. My fortification, which is called the Tower of Antonia, it was named after Mark Antony, that was going to be the headquarters for the Roman governor when he was in residence in Jerusalem. It was also going to be the headquarters of the military when they were where they were in Jerusalem, and he told them, you're not finished. My fort is not done. And if you can work around the clock for your temple, you absolutely are going to work around the clock for my fort. So Yeshua ben Si went to the high priest again. This time it was Eleazar. Eleazar died. Eleazar said, gave permission. And he said, we don't have any choice. The Roman governor is demanding this. So he gave his permission, then issued what is called the Sabbath of Weeks proclamation. The Sabbath of Weeks allowed the stonemasons to work an additional 126 Sabbath days. And that should be enough time for them to finish. And it was. They finished on March the 2nd of the year 2 AD with their work. And the following Sabbath day, they did have this great celebration. And the celebration pulled all of the stonemasons in, invited their families, their wives, their children, their neighbors, their friends. All the dignitaries came in to celebrate, and they had this celebration within the temple compound. There where the temple was going to continue to be built. As the sun rose that day, Yeshua ben Si stood up on a stone, and he brought attention to all the great work that these stonemasons were doing, and he said, even though they had to work on the Sabbath day, it was for the temple. And because it was for the temple, then it's okay for them to break the Sabbath. And so then the celebration began, and then 12 o'clock noon, Yeshua ben Si stood up again and brought attention again to the great work they had done. And then he says this, even though you had to work on the Sabbath day, which is contrary to the law of Moses, which actually should demand your life because you broke the Sabbath, because you were working on the temple, it's forgiven. But for working for the Romans on the Sabbath day, even though you had permission from the high priest, even though you had permission from, and the high priest said he spoke for God, from God himself, you broke the law of Moses. And for that, you will be punished. And with that, the right hand and the right arm of all 217 stonemasons were crushed. I'll never be able to use that hand in work ever again. The wives of those stonemasons were taken. Their right ear was removed, their right eye was removed, the right breast was removed, the right thumb removed, and the right big toe was removed. And they were forced to work in the garbage dump of Jerusalem, Gehenna, for the rest of their lives. Then the children were taken. Both eyes removed, both ears removed, both hands removed, both feet removed. And they were forced to beg in the streets of Jerusalem for the rest of their life. Then came the stonemason's disallowance. It's a proclamation that was given by the high priest. And Eleazar says this, that he speaks on behalf of God. And because they broke the law of Moses, then there will never be any forgiveness in this life or in the life to come. They were never allowed to see their families again, their wives again. God hated them. And they were placed on a list of the unforgivable as far as God was concerned. Every Sabbath day from that time forward, they had to go to their respective cities, towns, go to the synagogue, and they had to sit on the inside wall of the north wall of that synagogue. And there they would sit all day long while the leader of the synagogue criticized them. They would have to wear a red sash around their right arm, and that leader would say, "This is what God does to those who he hates. Those who break his laws, this is what God does." They were never allowed to make contact with anyone, any eye contact. No one was permitted to talk with them. No one was permitted to touch them or to acknowledge their existence. And this was their fate from that time for the rest of their life. By now, it had been over 25 years. By now, the arms were all worthless, shriveled up. Jesus went into the synagogue that day, and one of these stonemasons, exampled by Yeshua Benzi, was there that day. Jesus knew who he was. Everybody knew who they were. Everybody knew why they were there, what their positions were, why they were being punished. Everyone knew it. These men were unforgivable as far as religion was concerned, the Jewish religion. As far as the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, the priests, the rabbis, the religious leaders, they could never be forgiven because their sin was so, so, so great. Jesus arrived at the synagogue that day. We don't know if Jesus knew this man or not. Jesus, it never says whether Jesus had ever made his acquaintance or not. But Jesus did know who he was, certainly knew why he was there. Then Jesus looked at this man. The first time the man had been looked at for over 25 years. And then Jesus spoke to him. For the first time that anyone has spoken to him except through contempt and bitterness and hatred. And Jesus told him, "Stand up." Now the Pharisees, Jesus got their attention. We know this Jesus. We've heard about him healing lepers, the blinded eyes. We have even heard that Jesus lets a woman touch him. Can you imagine that? But even with that, even Jesus wouldn't countermand a proclamation by God himself through the high priest. Even Jesus wouldn't do that. And then Jesus referred back to that fateful day, that fateful Sabbath, and he asked them, "On the Sabbath day, what is appropriate, to save a man's life or destroy it?" What's it for? Well, they didn't answer him. But then Jesus, again, for only the second time in the past 25 years, the man was spoken to. And then Jesus said, "Sir, stretch forth your hand." And he stretched it out. He was totally and completely healed. And it was something more than the healing, though. Because what Jesus was saying to these people and to him, the man himself, was this: You are not cursed. This man is not cursed. He is not hated by God. He is a victim of one man's inhumanity to another. This man is a victim of religious persecution. And God does not hold him in contempt. God not only forgives him, but he accepts him as an equal to you guys. And he was healed.
Welcome to Cubit Farm. Welcome.
I'm standing in the midst of God's Widow's Farm, which is actually a local phenomenon around here. And what you're seeing are the grapes that come from this farm. Before God gave us this acreage, originally 6 acres, now 10 acres, this plot of land was producing about 1 ton of produce or grapes or whatever it was producing, about 1 ton an acre. But what has made this so phenomenal is that we're now averaging between 9 and 10 tons an acre on whatever is planted. Now, you see the grapes here, but we also raise eggplant, both black and yellow eggplant. There's corn, okra, squash. We have tomatoes, apricots, mangoes. And with the onions and grapes and onions and garlic and leeks, and it's just phenomenal. And what we do, we produce this, and the widows get the first crops, and we satisfy their needs first, and then once the widows are satisfied with the fresh produce, then we sell it, the remainder. And with the money that is that we get from the produce that we sell at market, then we can buy them blankets and shoes and school supplies and clothes and things like that that they need. And if they need to go to the doctor, then we can pay for their doctor's visit, dentist visits, and so forth. And so this God's Widow's Farm produces all of that. We're supporting about 1,200 widows a month, plus the children. And it's just absolutely phenomenal what God is doing here. And it's actually beyond belief, the type of produce that comes off this farm. And it's just, and there's no chemicals, no preservatives that goes into anything. It's just absolutely wonderful. And the taste is, again, phenomenal.
God's Widow's Farm is made possible by supporters of the Cubit Foundation. You can help today by visiting cubitfoundation.org and give your gift of hope today. Chase with Dr. Ron Charles is sponsored by supporters of the Cubit Foundation. Visit cubitfoundation.org for Dr. Ron's books and discover how you can support this global ministry.